your host for Lacrosse Talk PM, Rick Sola.
All right, welcome to a Tuesday. It's only Tuesday. 608-785-7914 is the talk and text line. Hit that button so that I'm caught up here and there's no delay. I'll turn the text line on so you guys can, so I can read the text. I got news. So right as the show started yesterday, I get this email from Pat Stevens at Rotary Lights. And if you haven't heard by now, the lights display, I don't know if it'll be delayed, but we talked to Pat today. I tried to get him on, but Brad stole him. Brad in the newsroom stole him before I could get him on the show. And I didn't want to take up all his time. But Saturday and Sunday, I guess. I'm not exactly sure if people... So a bunch of wires, essentially, but probably a little bit more expensive. Not your everyday extension cords. were cut and stolen from the Rotary Lights display. And Pat told Brad today about $13,000 worth of theft, damage, and delays. It'll be, I don't know, $13,000 worth of delays is a bright way to say that. But there could be delays in getting the lights display up. They have a month, literally 1 month from now, November 26th, is when the lights go live, hopefully. But they have this setback, and, you know, I'm sure police are doing what they can. There's cameras. While there wasn't any cameras on Hatched Baby, I learned that last week. We didn't have any video of actual vandalism of Hatch Baby. I believe we should. There's cameras in Riverside Park, so I'm guessing that we have some cameras of people. It still baffles me how we don't have video of this stuff sometimes, or we can't get an. I'm not a police expert, but we can't get to the bottom of these things. Now with this stuff, something was stolen, so they had to carry it to somewhere and throw it in a truck or a car. So I'm guessing that police will have video of them wherever the cameras are. You know, you got this camera and they're off camera here, and then they come back into view on the next camera or whatever. I don't know how many cameras are in Riverside Park. But beyond that, they have to eventually get in a car or truck or boat, I guess. Maybe they stopped at the docks at Riverside and took that stuff by boat. Is it harder to identify a boat? Maybe. Giving people ideas. Don't do that, people. And, you know, and then we'll have the car. And then once we get the car, then it seems like only a matter of time before you catch that. But I have no idea. Maybe we don't have that stuff on camera. We didn't have Hatch Baby vandalism on camera. That would be harder because even though I think you could look at all the cameras and say, oh, there's somebody with a giant face of a piece of art walking around. But if they jumped in the car and they did it right in front of Hatch Baby, they stopped the car, did the vandalism, jumped out, don't have a camera on the statue, then you're not going to have video of that. You're not even going to know what to look for. But, you know, the theory with Hatch Baby would be somebody walking from downtown and just stumbling on their way home does this while they're inebriated. So hopefully we can get to the bottom of the Rotary Lights incident. And, you know, selfishly, hopefully they're not delayed in putting these lights up, right? That's all we really care about. But if you want to, I had the website up. I have too many tabs open. If you want to, you know, right away I thought, go do a GoFundMe, but you don't have to do a GoFundMe. So if anyone wants to help donate as Rotary Lights hits this $10,000 to $13,000 setback and a bunch of stuff stolen, a bunch of, you know, electrical equipment and electrical wires stolen from them over the last weekend, you just go to rotarylights.org. There's a donate button right there. It sends you right to PayPal. So either have a PayPal account or you don't really need, I mean, you could just sign, you can pay with a credit card there. You don't even need to sign into a PayPal account if you want to donate to them. Because I'm like, yeah, just start a GoFundMe. This is the time to do it because everyone's going to be outraged by what happened and the way our attention spans work. You know, and in a week we'll forget about it and we won't be as outraged. So you kind of got to take advantage of the emotions, right? That's kind of how everything works, as sad as it is. But Pat Stevens, I guess, told Brad, and this will be on wisdomnews.com, probably not in not too long from now, the biggest ordeal might be replacing what was stolen, because we have, as we talked about last week, issues in the supply chain. So that would be a big hindrance. And you know what? If they can't find the stuff that they're looking to replace to get those lights on display, I wonder if you couldn't just start crowdsourcing. What do you need? I bet there's some electrical companies around here that would donate to Rotary Lights, you know, at least lend them the stuff and to let them use if they're not using it. I'm sure there's some electricians out there that have the materials that they would need. It's just a matter of getting the word out. So, hey, maybe anyone want to contact Rotary Lights if you think you can help. Check out wisdomnews.com to see the thing that they had stolen. Email Pat Stevens if you want. There's a contact us button right next to the donate button on rotarylights.org. And maybe you can help out. 608-785-7914 is the talk and text line. I was out at the south end of La Crosse today on the Mississippi River. Didn't have my goulashes on. Is that what you call those? Those were the things that my dad slipped over his shoes while he was working in the garage, so he didn't get his shoes wet. But I guess waders, a lot of people with waders on. We were at the Mississippi River. They were DNR and, a whole bunch of other organizations, governmental organizations, were out there trying to catch invasive carp. And so I'm going to have Randy Hines on with the USGS. He's a biologist right here in La Crosse, but he works for the USGS, United States Geological Survey. It's kind of a funny name, United States Geological Survey. Survey, you know, it just seems like there's more to it. And I just want to talk to him. I didn't tell him, but I kind of want to talk to him about how he got that job. I'd like to, I don't know if it's you remember the show Dirty Jobs. I don't know if it's a dirty job segment, but I kind of am interested in, you know, when these, obviously this is a unique job. So, you know, what's that job like? How do you get a job like that? How many hoops did he jump through to get to this position with the United States Geological Survey, part of the Department of Interior? So I'm going to talk to him about that. I'll talk to him about the invasive carp situation and the unique way that they go about keeping the invasive carp from getting upriver at a extreme amount, and B, how they catch him. Welcome back to La Crosse Talk PM. If you want to get in here, shoot me a text. If you got questions about fishing, for invasive carp, maybe, 608-785-7914 is the talk and text line. Make it the text line. Randy Hines is on with me now. He was down there on the south side. What pool is that, Randy? Pool 7?
Yes, Rick, that was pool 8.
Pool 8.
Across area.
Okay, and just on the south side there. Randy is a wildlife biologist with the U.S. Geological Survey, USGS, part of the Department of Interior. It sounds like you're pretty high up there when you start talking Department of Interior, Randy. Is that true? Are you pretty high up there? You can gloat if you want.
Well, I work for the Department of Interior, so that's one of the federal departments that has the responsibility for managing the nation's natural resources. And so USGS is the research arm of the federal government in the Department of Interior, and we work for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, National Park Service, Bureau of Land Management, and Indian Affairs. So those are the management resource agencies taking care of our resources. The USGS is all about science information.
All right. So it sounds like maybe you're the people that everybody else is. You're like the bottom of it. Everybody needs you to go do this and that, right? Like you got to go manage all these things.
Well, we're all about trying to work on high priority problems that those agencies have. So they're doing the daily hands-on management and taking care of things for the public citizens that own these resources. And so USGS is all about working on high priority problems like invasive carp, that we had an event here in La Crosse today.
Now, your office is right here in La Crosse too as well. I think, is it up on French Island?
That's correct. We're located on French Island. We initially started out down at the Riverside Park in the Tourism Bureau building on the north end and moved up here in the 1970s and have been here doing that type of research since.
Oh, Randy, you're way behind on city issues. The tourism, they're out of there. We're going through city council meetings and agendas and committees and public information sessions. We're trying to rent out that building. We're putting, I think, $1 million into renovating it, and then a group's going to come in and put another $1 million and make it like an event center. So your old Fish Labs building is no longer a fish lab.
That's correct. So that was where we started, and so some of the fish tanks are still in the walls down there from when we inhabited that building.
Do you think some of the fish smells, too?
Probably not, thank goodness.
Yeah, I did. I had a comedian on, Charlie Behrens, and we talked about whether or not, you know, when they have an event center there, if it's going to be a wedding venue, is that the best place to have a wedding venue because of what you guys maybe left in the basement with some fish guts or something?
No, just for us, it was a great place to be in the heart of town, so people knew about us, got to see what we did, but it wasn't a great place to raise fish and do environmental science when it flooded. So the basement always flooded.
Oh, really? Yeah, that's funny. Yeah, I think they filled it in now that I remember talking to the people that are talking about remodeling, and I think the basement is filled in. Yeah, how long did you work out of that building? And it must have been nice to be just downtown, right?
Yeah, 1959 is when the Fish Control Lab began down there, and their effort was focused on common carp and a non-desirable species of fish like what we're trying to work on still today. And so we were there until about mid-1970s, occupied the facility up here on French Island, the Upper Midwest Environmental Sciences Center, in 1978 with staff.
Okay, and have you been? That seems too long. You couldn't have been part of that, right?
I came in 1993, and so some of the staff that were originally down at Riverside Park that came up here to this new facility back then were still part of the staff, and so I was able to overlap with some of them for several years.
Okay, yeah, so you have a little bit of I was going to say, I saw you. We talked down on the south side. You're not that old. So you weren't doing that stuff back in 78. Working as a wildlife biologist for the Department of Interior Geological Survey, you're working right here in La Crosse, but what kind of schooling did you go through to get to the position you're at?
So I have a bachelor's degree, a four-year degree, and then went on to receive a master's degree. And so staff here at the facility have bachelor's, master's, and PhD. So for a research agency, research scientists typically are going to have a PhD level of experience.
Does everybody pick on you then because you don't have a PhD?
No, we've got a good mix of staff across all of those. So great camaraderie and some talented scientists.
And then were you straight biology? So I went to Stevens Point, which is a pretty good biology school, I think, a pretty good school for doing what you're doing. But I took bio, I think it was Bio 160, was the first biology class I took, and I dropped it before getting the F. So it was not for me because I was trying to be a phi ed teacher, and then I had to learn all the biology, and I was like, this is not phi ed. I don't want to do this. And now, 20 years later, I'm like kind of into all the stuff that you do. So I kind of wish I would have stuck with it a little bit, although I get to experience this in a different way. So did you go straight biology, just years and years of studying that stuff?
Yeah, I think most of us have had a variety of different avenues that we've taken, but mine was zoology and wildlife ecology. And then I had a master's degree in forestry and integrated resource management. So you've got a wide variety of natural resource-related, science-related fields that can get people into this field.
Now you're in, what do you call the building? You don't call it a fish lab up there on French Island, do you?
No, this Upper Midwest Environmental Sciences Center, it's broadened its mission from what we originally started down there in fish control. That was specifically our mission to work on non-desirable, non-indigenous or invasive species like common carp and sea lamprey. And so when we moved up here, it expanded its mission in the 70s to focus on Mississippi River and freshwater ecology. And then we continued to have a variety of different Department of Interior co-located research groups here. And so we expanded the mission to include fisheries contaminants, wildlife contaminants, as well as wildlife ecology. So we now work on terrestrial and aquatic ecosystems.
And you've been, you know, you're closing in. If you started in 93, you're closing in on 30 years. Can you do a timeline of like some of the priorities that have changed with Mississippi River and ecology there in our area? And like how has the environment changed? How have the priorities changed and, you know, the things that you're working on?
A great question. Over the past 31 years, I've seen a lot of different changes, and so staff need to be trained in a wide variety of ecology now, and so we need to be able to work across disciplines. So initially when folks came in, and a lot of the tasks were specific to toxicology and focus on trying to control animals, but as we have moved into climate change and lots of different large-scale ecosystem challenges that we're facing, like invasive species, we need to be able to work with a wide variety of staff. And so I think the key is being flexible, being broad-based, and being able to work with a wide range of scientists and managers.
Are there specific things, though, maybe that you're working on, besides invasive carp, because we're going to get to that in a minute, that you guys are working out of that office that seem like a top priority?
Yeah, I mean, just within invasive species, there's been a huge change in the type of approach that we've used. Early on, they used to try to use chemical control. So the lab was known as a fish control lab. They did research on thousands of different chemicals to see which one showed promise to control sea lamprey and common carp. They were successful in finding some, very few, but a few of those that were selective just by chance. And so as we continue to focus moving forward, we're using newer and newer technology, looking at trying to target delivery of chemicals, as well as using sound, CO2, and a wide variety of different mechanisms. Other issues that have changed along the way have been things like nutrients. Nutrients have continued to be an issue in the Mississippi River. Excess sediment, nutrients running off the landscape into the Mississippi River is a continuing problem, and we're having harmful algal blooms and increased algae out there in the ecosystem, and so that can hurt the plant life on the Mississippi River. So a lot of different things have either changed in terms of their intensity or they've not been solved. We've worked on monarchs as a good example, too. So monarch butterflies across the nation and in this continent are experiencing decline. And so we've increased our capacity to be able to work on those kinds of issues by using modeling. So going from just focusing on individual animals and biology, but looking at ecosystem-level modeling and predicting what might happen to animals in the future, like extinction.
We're speaking with Randy Hines. He's a wildlife biologist for the USGS, part of the Department of Interior. Randy, how much of your job is just, you know, not sitting on the phone and talking to the radio guy, but is sitting in the office, and how much of it is, you know, getting your feet dirty?
My first 15 years here at the center were field-based and laboratory-based research for me specifically, and a lot of staff will spend a tremendous amount of time in the field conducting field science. There are groups of scientists and teams here that focus entirely in the labs. And so we have a wide variety of that type of focus. And so the beauty of the staff here and the facility, we can work on a genetic or subcellular level of the organism, as well as populations and animals and habitats and restoration out in the environment. So a lot of staff will spend a variety of their time seasonally out in the field and then be back here in the lab behind the computer and crunching data.
Yeah, if this is, you know, if you wanted to describe this job to somebody that's kind of maybe in the high school level, moving on to college and thinking about it, can you talk about, there's a variety here. It's not all test tubes and beakers, right? There's quite a bit of, like we saw today, a guy catching, measuring, and throwing fish back into the Mississippi.
I think one of the misleading things is when people hear the word biologist, there's about 180 different kinds of biologists compared to when I was in high school. And so to think broadly about what a scientist or a biologist might do, working for different agencies. So if you like to work in the outdoors, you like to work in a laboratory, you like to solve problems and work as a part of a team, on challenges, it's part of what it takes to be a scientist and a biologist. So working well with people, as well as wanting to understand what we currently don't know and get that information out there to move our knowledge forward.
How hard was it to get your master's degree in biology to get to the position you were? I mean, did you have to, the ladder had to be pretty, it probably took you a while to get to the to where you're at, right?
Yeah, you're looking at about 6 years to finish a bachelor's and a master's degree on average. And so to get a PhD, you're looking at several more years of schooling beyond that. But if you truly are interested in the outdoor field or science field, it's something that should come naturally, and it shouldn't be a matter of a number of years like some people typically get hung up on when they're in high school. They think the number of years at school, but if you're passionate about what you want to do and you're in the right field and you're in the right program, things don't typically seem like you're taking that long. It goes pretty fast.
And when you start out in this field, though, you're literally in the field. Like is it kind of like almost a hazing? You got to do a lot of literal dirty work?
The jobs involve a lot of things. Being able to fabricate equipment inside in the labs that's not taught in school. There's also a lot of things on the fly out in the field about handling boats, vehicles, driving across country and working in different environments, hot, cold environments, day and night, weekends, those types of things can be part of the routine.
How many times have you maybe fell through the ice or just like, kind of embarrassing moments? You got any of those just out in the field?
You know, just working at nighttime, you never know what you're going to be involved with. We did a lot of research on common loons in the past, and so being out in a boat playing taped calls of breeding, calling loons can sometimes be a little eerie, and so you never know what you might run into in the environment out there.
We're speaking with Randy Hines. He's a wildlife biologist for the USGS. There were probably about, I know there were 10 boats out there, Randy. How many of you were out there on the south side today working on catching carp?
We had a variety of different agencies down there today. So the USGS was part of the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources, the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service efforts to see if we could learn how many carp are out there in the Pool 8 area and see about harvesting some of those to reduce the pressure on the natural resources.
Yeah, I want to say 10 boats, probably about 20 of you. All right, we're gonna talk with Randy about what they were exactly doing and what they want to accomplish. But we got to get to Scott's comment. Brad doing the news. We'll be back after this. All right, welcome back to Lacrosse Talk PM. 608-785-7914 is the text line. If anyone wants to text, they got questions for Randy Hines, a wildlife biologist for the USGS. In the Department of Interior, works out of the French Island office. I got it right here, Randy, on your card. Upper Midwest Environmental Sciences Center. Is that pretty fancy? It's not that old, right? It's got to be a pretty fancy building.
Yes, that building was built and occupied in 1978.
Okay, never mind. It's better than the Fish Labs building that was built like 100 years ago or something. All right, so I want to talk about obviously what you guys are doing all week on the Pool 8 and probably some different pools. But when we say Pool 8, just the Mississippi River, it's on the south side, and I think are you going up to French Island too and trying to catch invasive carp, right?
Correct. So the state agencies were focusing their efforts where they have known locations of carp, either through commercial fishermen as well as their own experience. And so it's pretty much in the upper half of the pool.
Okay. And the carp that we're looking for, I guess you're just telling me there's five different type of carp, but the ones that we're really trying to get are called silver and bighead carp. And just they ended up here because of there's a fish hatchery or something. That they end up too close to the Mississippi River, that hatchery floods and those carp get into the river, right?
Correct. All five species of the carp were brought over here on purpose or on accident. So it's typical that these species escape into the wild, and that's what the silver and bighead that we're currently concerned about in this area having an impact on the ecosystem.
Yeah, and I think when people think of the invasive carp, they probably, because they're such big fish, they probably think they're coming here and eating all our little fish, but that's not the case at all, right?
No, silver and bighead carp are unique in their design, and so they are a filter feeder. So they will take in algae and plankton, so phytoplankton, the plant material, as well as zooplankton, tiny little invertebrates.
And why, that doesn't sound so bad. Why do we care if they do that or not? If they're not eating our fish that we want to eat, then what's the big deal?
they're eating at the bottom of the food chain. So when you think about the food pyramid, you've literally got the most abundant food at the bottom of the food pyramid. And so that's going to be your algae and your plankton community. And so all of your baby fish, all of our native game fish and commercial fish rely on that source. And some may shift over to be predators, but a lot of those fish depend on it for their entire life. So stealing food and competing for food at the bottom of the food chain is definitely the biggest competition.
For people that are fishermen and out on the Mississippi, if they, you know, is it hard to identify one of these carp, and what should they do with them if they do catch one?
Yeah, that's a great question. If people suspect that they have a carp, if a silver carp that is known as the jumping carp land in their boat, they need to turn that fish into the local DNR office or Fish and Wildlife Service. And let them know. If they suspect they've seen jumping carp in locations, they should also notify the DNR so they can try to focus on those areas and investigate. But definitely don't want to let those fish go. They don't want to let them go back into the wild. So anytime they capture or encounter a fish like that, they should let the DNR know.
Yeah, and these silver carp, when you say they're jumping and they might jump in your boat, are they real? Because we didn't see any today, obviously. But are they? Is it that crazy that they're just jumping around like that?
Well, the silver carp become agitated when boat motors are around, in and around them. So there's certain RPMs within that 100 horsepower boat motor that will cause those fish to jump. And so it's a frightening response to get away from that. So big heads don't jump. They dive down, as opposed to the silvers that are nicknamed the jumping carp.
Okay, so they kind of do the opposite. And this is where it gets interesting, because you were talking about using chemicals sometimes to get rid of invasive species. And I think we're slowly evolving to the point where it's not always the greatest thing to throw a bunch of chemicals in our water supply. But you guys learn that these carp are deterred by the sound of boat motors. And then can you talk about the evolution of that science?
I think what we've seen over time is focusing in on the biology and the anatomy and physiology of these animals. We know that they respond to boat motors and sounds, underwater sounds, and so that complex sound has been something we've focused on for several years now and been developing the use of sound for deterrence as well as a driving, herding technique. And so as opposed to chemicals in the past, chemicals were typically used and they were non-selective. And so one of the focuses on chemicals currently today is to use different delivery systems and different ways of packaging up a chemical into a very specific particle specific to the food size of the animal and having it open up in the presence of the right chemicals or enzymes inside the animal. So there's new ways of delivering this type of technology, but sound is definitely one we've been using today.
Yeah, you're trying to herd invasive carp with sound. There were your boats on the south side today had speakers on them. Are you playing? What kind of music are you playing then?
Well, it's not music, but it's a type of sound that is a playoff, a spinoff from a 100 horsepower engine. So we worked with the University of Minnesota Duluth in the past to hone in and look at the response of carp based on that sound, and now we're currently been working with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers Engineer Research and Development Center in Mississippi, and the idea is to tease apart that 100 horsepower engine and find out specifically what components of that sound are what the carp are responding to. And so that sound is capable of being played underwater in a speaker system on the boats like today, along with electrofishing and placing electricity in the water so that we can actually manage their behavior and drive them from cell to cell and close those cells behind them on the mum effort.
And today, along with, I think there were 10 boats out there and they all have speakers on them, although I didn't, are the speakers underwater at some point?
Yeah, so not all of the boats. Some of the boats were just netting boats, so yep. They were the ones in charge of placing block nets out there and closing cells off. The other boats either had electric current on there, electroshocking boats that are typically used for surveillance and monitoring of fish populations, and then a number of those boats had the speakers underwater placed on each side of the front of the bow.
Yeah, so essentially you have a couple of boats with speakers and electrical devices to herd the fish, and then you had a giant net around a huge area of the Mississippi River tonight, and then you just slowly, like, you pull that net in. Essentially, you collapse it, but we didn't catch any invasive carp. Is that good news or bad news?
Yeah, that was good news. So, I mean, the fact that this spring we sampled collectively as a partnership in these same areas and they harvested 34 silver carp was alarming back then. And so this fall we did not capture any of those. We did have a fish that was tagged back in the fall of 2020, and so that fish helped us locate some of these schools of fish both in the spring, and they did see that fish in this backwater where we were seining today, but unfortunately the few fish that were around were not captured.
Have we learned that
in that location?
Have we learned that these invasive carp like to hang out like in schools of fish? You often see that in the ocean. I don't know. Do they like to hang out together, and that's why if you tag one, you hopefully there'll be others by it?
Yeah, that's exactly the point, is to find to use that schooling behavior and help us find the locations where they concentrate. As the water gets colder, they tend to go into these locations and they tend to school up, and they don't jump as much in the wintertime. And so these are areas where the DNR has the ability to go in and try to harvest them and reduce their numbers so that they lessen the impact on the ecosystem and the species.
We're speaking with Randy Hines. He's a wildlife biologist for the USGS. And over the course of this week, they're trying to catch invasive carp. The kind that they're looking for are silver and bighead. Those two carp come from China, right?
Correct. The five species of carp that we have in the United States came from Europe and Asia. And so those species are known as invasive carp.
All right. And this whole thing got started, I don't know if it got started literally here in the area, but 2 years ago, I believe, the story that I heard from the DNR guy was that some commercial fishermen ended up catching 50 of these invasive carp all at one time a couple of years ago, and that kind of set off a bunch of, not literal alarms, but some alarms there with the DNR and with you guys?
I think you're exactly right. The commercial fishermen are out there year-round and put a lot of miles of nets out there, so they're very likely to encounter these species. And so when they caught that many and notified the DNR, the Minnesota DNR became concerned, and so they started this conversation and effort with the partners that we're currently working on. So taking this technique and using it across the country, the MUM has been used to harvest large quantities of carp that are found in Missouri, Kentucky, and Illinois water systems. But up here with the lower density of carp, what we're trying to do is try to get a control on those animals that might be here and curb their ability to reproduce and you know, potentially develop a self-sustaining population up here.
Do they like the cold water? As they get, you know, a lot of these, you know, with a lot of species, they just eventually winter comes and they're out. They don't want to be around anymore.
Yeah, no, these species tolerate our colder water. They could be found all the way to Canada. They were found in northern China, where they originally came from. And so it definitely, cold water is not a problem for these fish. But they do concentrate during the colder seasons in areas like this that gives us the ability to go in and do something about it.
That was probably a dumb Rick failed biology in college class, because fish are cold-blooded and they probably don't care about cold water as much.
slows them down a little bit.
It's kind of interesting. So when you talk about you're trying to herd these things, and that all started somehow with a 100-horsepower motor, and then you guys dissect the motor to figure out what part of the sound that really bugs the fish to kind of harness that sound. Does that come from at all from like the barges going up and down the river?
No, that it really didn't. I mean, one of the efforts, the MUM came from the Chinese used this. The modified method they use in China was all about trying to harvest fish commercially. So they typically use that compartmentalizing of nets and driving their fish to be very efficient. And so we brought that technique over here and modified it. Dwayne Chapman with the USGS in Missouri modified this to where we started using side-scan sonar technology, sound, and electrofishing as additional features to the netting, and in order to increase the efficiency of using that tool to capture and harvest these fish.
I'm getting a text question here. Do these carp compete against the zebra mussels for food sources?
They do feed at the same level or similar level. Zebra mussels do feed at the algae and plankton level as well. So they're both filter feeders. And the problem with having two of those in the same system is you had an additive effect to to the ecosystem by having filtration by zebra mussels and filtration by several species of carp. You can really hurt the food chain even faster.
Now, when you guys, if and when you guys catch any of these invasive carp this week, who gets to pull rank on taking these home for a Friday fish fry? Because you guys are done on Friday. Then you have a big fish fry and you fry up all these invasive carp or what?
No, unfortunately not. So the Fish and Wildlife Service, their job was to process fish. And so their interest was to take age and weight and length of these fish and take their ear stones out. And then that from that ear stone, they can look at some of their characteristics about where they originated from and also a little bit more about their specific age.
Yeah, you were telling me, too, earlier today that you guys, you know, if you can't find any of the fish, you actually, you can kind of almost, I'm not going to get this right, but like search for their DNA, you can kind of find traces of where they were at in the water?
Correct. So some of the effort's been over several years now to be looking up and down the Mississippi River to look for the presence of environmental DNA or eDNA, the genetic material given off by these fish. It's specific, and so the tests are specifically designed with markers for these fish. So the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in Onalaska and the USGS here on French Island have developed techniques to look at eDNA in the water column. So taking a quick water sample and analyzing it for the presence of genetic material could give us an indication, a relative indication of location, maybe the population status about how many there might be there. And what we did with the mum now is we're looking pre and post harvest in these areas so that we can see if there's a degradation of material or a disappearance of material after we harvest any carp that might be present.
All right, Randy, last thing. The Wisconsin DNR guy, Jordan, told me that there's hundreds of thousands of these invasive carp as you get closer to the Gulf of Mexico. I don't know how far down before. Is that a huge problem? And is it just, and if we just let it go up here, what would it do? Like hundreds of thousands of these fish in the area, would it just ruin what the Mississippi is all about? Would they just take over or what?
One of the biggest concerns you're looking at in the Illinois River is a great example, is you've got a high density of these carp. And so when you have that high density, you have crowding and removal of food. And so you start to see a decrease in commercial and recreational valuable fish. So you can see a loss of fishing opportunities and economic sustainability for businesses that rely on that type of recreation. And you might also have some impacts to recreational boaters if the silver carp established to where they start jumping and hitting boaters and fishermen.
Yeah, water skiers will end up with carp in their face, huh?
Unfortunately.
Yeah, okay. It just seems like if you just let it go, then maybe we would just have to change the industry and then we would just, on Fridays, instead of a perch dinner, we have a carp dinner.
Well, the fish tissue itself is very white and flaky, and the people that try it say that it's very good. It has a bone structure that's different from what most Americans like to handle and work through to get their food, but it is a potential use for a food resource. It's being used for animal feed and for fertilizer, and so that's the potential. But most people with the name carp, they tend to associate it with common carp and not a good flavor.
Is what you're doing, is it kind of a losing cause or losing battle? Eventually this isn't, or can we stop it?
Yeah, I think we've come a long way in 10 years with the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative funding, trying to work on this effort to stop carp from getting into the Great Lakes, as well as expanding the range in the Mississippi and the Tennessee Cumberland River systems. And so as we learn more, we're getting more effective and efficient at how we can deploy tools. So it's taken us about 10 years to get to the point where we're doing field deployment of a lot of technology and a lot of research that's been ongoing. It just isn't happening overnight. So I think the key is we're getting there, we're getting tools, we're getting better and better at how to work together and deploy some of this technology out there to make an impact on the range expansion and impact of these carp.
All right, Randy, thanks a lot for joining me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Rick.
All right, that was Randy Hines, wildlife biologist for the USGS, part of the Department of Interior. All right, one more break, we'll wrap up. All right, that's going to wrap it up for today. Appreciate Randy Hines coming on and getting grilled about his job at the USGS, being a biologist. I always think it's interesting, some of the jobs that are out there, politicians, but these jobs, these dirty jobs, literally out in the woods.